Mr. Trace.
Thanks very much, Tyler. Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. First of all, an apology. I seem to be the least formally dressed person in the conference at the moment. I thought I was safe coming to a Sunday day of a cannabis conference, but obviously misjudged. Yeah. So, so you want authority and credibility from your moderator, but I'm afraid you've got the casual guy. I've done a few jobs around drug policy over the last 25 years, and a couple of those official responsibilities came across issues around cannabis reforms short of legalization, which all cannabis reforms in my day were short of legalization. And I now work in the NGO sector in a range of responsibility within the UK prisons, but also chairman, as was mentioned, of International Drug Policy Consortium. We have a very distinguished panel who will be able to give their perspectives on this subject, and we will do the traditional run of three panel presentations in the order first Norm Wetterau, then Bo Kilmer, then Kevin Sabet. So they'll have 10 to 15 minutes each, and then we'll have a period of moderated questions. So looks like about the right size of room, size of audience. We should get a nice little debate going after we've heard the prepared speeches. A few introductory comments from me. I'm really pleased this session is on this program, because all the exciting stuff, and the guys in the big room downstairs, is all about, yes, people are implemented legalization, let's see how it's going, let's see what happens next, let's see where it takes us in evaluation and review terms. Most things that have happened around cannabis reform in the world, and most things that will happen, I would argue, in the next 10 years, will be reforms short of legalization. So I'm glad there is a session on that subject. Whatever happens in the US, Canada, Uruguay, a couple of other countries, the next couple of years, most things that happen around the world, most government work will be around reforms short of legalization. There's an excellent summary, and I see Ed's in the room. Release, UK charity, has produced a summary of what has happened so far in what they focus around cannabis reforms or decriminalisation. I don't know if you have copies of that document in the room, in the building, Ed, but you're speaking this afternoon. Well, Ed will do the advert for himself later, but there is a web link to a summary published recently of what reforms have been tried in what part of the world, and that's a really useful digest. Many of these reforms have actually been celebrated and debated all around the world. So the decriminalisation in Portugal, everybody's got a view. Everybody talks about it. It's been reviewed and analysed. João Goulart, who is the architect or one of the main champions of those reforms, is a good friend. And we do joke sometimes with João that Portugal has had far too much attention from the international drug policy community the last 10 years. But it's an interesting example that everybody likes to talk about. But you have to remember, there's things going on, some of them planned and some of them accidental, in a lot of countries around the world that don't get talked about. And my favorite to throw is a kind of a hand grenade into the debate is some of the most fundamental differences in how cannabis is treated in societies are not policies at all. They're not proactive, reasoned, thought through government policy changes. My favorite country is Pakistan. Every time I see Pakistan in an international drug policy debate, absolute zero tolerance to cannabis. Absolute zero tolerance on drug policy. These things are prohibited. We have the toughest possible penalties. We have the death penalty for certain offenses. Anybody who's been to Pakistan, there's a pretty thriving cannabis market in Pakistan and a tolerated cannabis market in Pakistan in many parts of that country. Now, I don't mean to focus just on that country or the difference between policy and practice, but there is something very real there that actually some of the most impactful things that are done around cannabis in many countries is do nothing. Not even talk about it, not even think about it. So just want to throw that one in to remind people when we're talking about carefully planned, carefully evaluated initiatives. I want to give my help to the debate by giving my definitions, and I hope it does help, because when we talk about reforms short of legalization, we do have a definitional problem. Now, this is very much from a European perspective, and I know the definitions are slightly different in the mainstream in the US debate. But there are reforms you can follow, and countries have been following around cannabis reforms, and I call first typology I call is depenalization. So you still have a criminal justice process, offenses are illegal, and these are the process you would mainly have seen in Europe in the last couple of decades and many other countries around the world, is the criminal offense is still in place, the criminal justice process is still the basis of what's been followed, but the penalties are reduced. My own country, the UK, continues to arrest very large numbers of cannabis users, although the trend is coming down in recent years, but we then let them go again. So that's pretty much the UK policy. Arrest lots of people, let them go again. That's depenalization, or one form of it. Decriminalization, this does have debates around the definition of decriminalization, but it seems to me that it's fundamentally two things. It's making legal some offences around cannabis consumption and market. So decriminalisation can be, most typically as we see, sort of it is not illegal, or it is a civil penalty or a civil offence to possess and consume under a certain threshold. You know, that to me is decriminalisation. But also, and I mentioned the Portuguese example, it could be that the whole range of offences are dealt with through civil procedures rather than through criminal procedures. So both of those, to me, fit within a definition of decriminalisation, but I know that's contested. Then, of course, as you all know, legalisation is where you talk about regulation of the entire market, possession, production, distribution. But not remembering as well, there are many areas of reform that have been taken place within the medical and scientific field. And this is about licensing regimes, exemptions from criminal legislation, and medicines control processes and research processes. So all sorts of things can be done in those areas without creating a regulated market. So there are many options. Countries over the last 10 years particularly, and I think from what we heard from the plenary, countries in local administrations in the next 10 years will be implementing a wide range of those options with a wide range of quality. So we need clarity on what the objectives are of those measures, and we need good evaluation frameworks to say, well, actually, did these initiatives reduce harm, increase harm, improve health, improve social functioning, so on and so forth. So setting the objectives and evaluating against them is the way we need to approach these challenges. So with that scene-setting comments from me, all I'm going to do for the rest of the session is introduce people and moderate the questions. I'll now pass over to our speakers, and the first of those will be Norm Wetterau from ASAM. They're all on, I think.
Dr. Norm Wetterau. I was a family physician for years. I do addiction medicine. I'm on the board of the American Society of Addiction Medicine, and we just met. I just came up from Washington, and we were talking about increasing the workforce for our opioid problems, and we may need to increase it for some other problems too. We have a lot of work to do. Anyway, our organization. So let me see. Is this okay? Well. Oh, I see. Okay, so I'm going to have to work hard to... Okay, I know this pretty well. Okay, so anyway, this past year, both the American Academy of Pediatrics and the American Society of Addiction Medicine came out with new policy statements on marijuana. And they're both, you know, they're online. Go to the AAP or the ASAM websites, and you can certainly read these. Now, I was on the writing committee for the ASAM. We spent 6 months getting feedback from the board, from all kinds of people, and because doctors are not always focused on policy. I learned a lot this morning. So we had to get ourselves focused and figured out, you know, what we're saying, but the board unanimously approved our policy, and I was really happy to be able to be involved in writing it, and I certainly learned a lot. So I'm going to share a little of that, and I wanted to mention that the Academy of Pediatrics, they actually have two documents. We have one document, which is here, and it has about 100 references and policy statements. And then the pediatricians, they have a shorter policy statement, but they have a technical paper, which has like 200 references. And they really systematically review the literature. Now, we both came to the same type of conclusions, that do not support legalization, but we're in favor of decriminalization. Now, their paper doesn't define too much about decriminalization, But they do, in their technical paper, review a lot of the attempts around the world to do this. And we have a short definition, and I'm going to expand a little bit of it. It's rather idealistic, extremely idealistic, but maybe we start there. I want to mention one study, first of all. There's a lot of studies, and the pediatricians concluded that even legalizing it for adults is going to have a huge spillover into the youth in the stuff we're hearing. And both organizations, we're concerned about any age because of the addiction and the problems there, but we're extremely concerned about the youth. Now, we have not had a lot of good studies. You know, we really need to take people when they're 15 and follow them for 10 years to find out what happens. And I've been told just that the federal government here may be starting this type of study. It would take 10 years. It's going to be a good study. Australia and New Zealand have these studies. And there's a summary here of, in which they sort of brought the three together. Now, I realize from a scientific each of these studies has some flaws, and you take three slightly flawed studies and put them together, but I think it has something that's worth seeing, and it's really driving us physicians to be very concerned. So, first of all, they looked at when kids were before 18, they smoked marijuana less than monthly, weekly, or more. So you had about 200 people in the monthly and about 200 kids in the weekly or more category. So what happens 10 years later when they check on them? And so basically high school completion of the weekly or more, only about half finished high school. And the monthly was 70%. I was surprised that only 80% of the non-users completed high school, but that's what the study found. Now, cannabis dependence. So this is not when they were in high school, but 10 years later, do they meet the qualifications of cannabis dependence? And so you find out that about half of those that used it weekly or more in high school, that's what they had. And I think downstairs we heard some similar, you know, that there's a group of people that will become dependent, and like 100 times, and this is that group. Then what about using other drugs? So about a third of the people that were smoking marijuana weekly were using other drugs as adults, less than monthly, 21%, and the people that never used in high school, still 9%, had other drug issues. Now, the three studies are different, so there's some flaws in this, but this gives you an idea of what concerns us as physicians on this problem. And I will tell you, in my own practice, my wife was a high school teacher in a small community. I've seen, and this is true, this is what we see. Now, what causes it? I think the marijuana is a major factor. But anyway, so and most of my colleagues in our organization sort of see the same thing in our patients, apart from any study. Okay, so we support the decriminalization of marijuana, and which would reduce penalties for marijuana possession for personal use to civil offenses linked to contingencies, such as mandated referral to clinical assessment, educational activities, and when indicated, formal treatment for addiction or other substance-related disorders. We're not saying that everyone that smokes marijuana needs treatment, but at least they need an evaluation as part of that. And then we do not support legalization of marijuana, but where it's been legalized, we think these are natural experiments, and we would really like to see some good research on this, not just research by certain with special interest groups, but federal or other bias, NYU or other groups, you know, really taking a look over the next 10 years. Because, you know, hey, if half the people stop drinking in those states, you know, I might change my position. But I want to see that happen. And so that's where we are. So I want to talk a little bit. We don't define contingencies. We don't define too much what we want. But let me give you some ideas. And what we really need is some research. We need some a county judge and doctors get together and say, let's try this in our area, see what happens, let's study it, or a university that says, we're going to try this and see whether any of what we're talking about works. You know, if it helps 20% of the people, I would consider that positive. What we don't think is healthy is putting people in jail. This is my personal opinion. I think kicking them out of school is not particularly a good thing to do for punishing them, but they shouldn't be bringing marijuana to school and smoking it. So, you know, how do we deal with that? And then I don't think that fines are necessarily. So we have a $100 fine in New York State. I think we can do better than that. I don't mean more money, other things. So what are we talking about? Well, this is evaluation. You know, maybe maybe the first evaluation will be an online evaluation. Be very confidential. And we wouldn't just evaluate for how often you use marijuana, do you use other drugs, how are you doing in school, do you have evidence of depression, do you have evidence of anxiety? It's just certain questions. And then maybe and there's things like this, particularly if you go online, Rethinking Drinking will evaluate you online and will give you feedback and suggestions. So that's what this idea is. And then it might suggest, listen, your marijuana use isn't too much, but you may end up using more. You seem to have concerns about your family and school and this. And maybe you'd like to talk to somebody about this, and then it can give you some names, or it can give you an 800 number, or whatever it is, and then you can do that. So that's the kind of thing we're thinking about. Maybe the second offense, you'd have to see somebody. Now, the problem, of course, you don't collect fine money. Instead, somebody has to pay for this. The online thing would not be very expensive. But I think it's an investment in kids. It's an investment in adults. And you could, I guess, make them pay their own for a fine. But I'd love to see it free, and then see what you can do. This is very idealistic, but I think it has potential. And if 20% of the people get help, I think that would be really a good thing. Now, so those are some of the things we're looking for. Now, what are kind of contingencies? Well, that's really sort of tough. I guess you could have a fine. That's probably what it would be if you don't show up or don't do it. Could you lose your driver's license? Other kinds of comfort things. Now, I think this is my personal idea, not the committee. This was not discussed. I think this should be extremely confidential so that no one has any access. But if you don't show up for your evaluation, or you just blow it off, then your name would go on the list, on the internet. And then people could check, but as soon as you do your evaluation, it comes off. So that might be an interest. I'm just throwing out some creative ideas, and I hope people begin to try these things and see if any of it works. Because what we're doing now isn't very helpful, whether it's JO or fines or anything else. Okay, so that's, let's see here. That's the main thing. We have a number of other recommendations. So we realize that marijuana is going to be legal in certain states, and so we believe, for example, there should be warning labels. And it should only be, say, sold in state stores. It shouldn't be sold to young people. And that those states need to really take an interest in advertising the problems and highlighting the risks, and there should be labels. So there's three high-risk groups for marijuana. And when you hear this, you're going to suddenly realize, and we actually sort of heard this downstairs a little bit. These are the people that are going to really get in trouble. So first of all, young people that continue to smoke because of the effects. But the other two groups are those with mental illness, because it doesn't really make mental illness better, not just the psychosis. Sure, if you have an anxiety disorder, six drinks, a couple of joints, some opioids, or whatever, it does make you feel better. But I end up seeing those patients after a while, because it doesn't work long term. And the other thing is those with addictions involving alcohol or other drugs, because one of the things, that addiction is a brain disease, there's a section of the brain, and once you have an addiction to one thing, they seem to trigger off. So alcohol and cocaine, alcohol and tobacco, well, it's the same center in the brain. You stop one thing and use another. And so we have concerns that people that have other addictions really should not be smoking marijuana. That's why we try to get them to stop everything. Or if I have a person that smokes marijuana and they want opioids for chronic pain, or they smoke tobacco and they want opioids for chronic pain, they're really at high risk of developing opioid problems, because these things are all, there's biochemical and neurophysiologic reasons for that. And I think, so those are high-risk groups. And I think that people don't appreciate that. Now, when you really think about it, we started having warning labels. If you have mental illness, if you have other addictions, and if you're under 25 or under 20, you shouldn't be smoking marijuana. I'm not sure who's left, but I guess, as we learned downstairs, maybe about 3% of the people that would be safe, more likely to be safe users. So those are some of our concerns. And we have other recommendations. Medical marijuana, we have some recommendations. Really, the New York State law is pretty interesting. I think if you're going to have a law, that's a good law. Things like, why does medical marijuana look like candy and cookies? I mean, this is the kind of thing that's just, it's ridiculous. There's nothing medical about it. I just find it amazing that that got through legislatures and is allowed. New York State is not going to be like that at all. If you need medical marijuana, see a doctor in New York State. Maybe you'll get the right stuff. So we have a lot of other clinical recommendations. I wanted to, student assistance programs in middle schools and high school, expand, and one of the whole things of these interventions, should they be internet or should they be based on a doctor's office or a clinic, or should we send them to the school counselor? Those are things that a lot of stuff's being done through schools now, and this has to be examined and looked at and so forth. So what is effective? And it has to be financed. We have to be committed. If we decide to legalize it, how committed are we to these issues and to the medical problem? And I think that's probably part of the problem. Are we willing to be committed to really what decriminalization is? We certainly are committed to when we put people in prison. Well, how about this? And there's another thing. This is for doctors. We have a bunch of recommendations for doctors and so on. So the people that are being treated for one substance use disorder, advising our patients that they need to abstain from marijuana as well as alcohol and so on, because it precipitates relapse. And we see that all the time in all kinds of substances. So I think that's about it. I encourage you to go online and look at our statement and also the Academy of Pediatrics, AAP, I think.
Thanks very much, Norm. As far as possible, as I said at the top of the meeting, we'll try and have questions and discussion after you've heard from all three speakers, but should give the opportunity. Are there any specific questions or clarification from what Norm has said there before we move on? Okay, perfectly clear, Norm. Thanks very much. And now I'm going to pass over to our second speaker, Bo Kilmer from RAND. Bo, take it away.
Yeah, thank you, Mike. And it really is a thrill to be here. Nice to see a number of familiar faces, but also to be having a discussion about marijuana that isn't necessarily about supply. I think it's possible. to be having a discussion, really focus on possession laws. And that I do think it's possible to improve social welfare by not touching supply. Now, don't get me wrong, I really enjoy talking about supply issues, but look, most of the conference is going to be about this. It's really nice to have a panel that's largely focused on possession issues, especially since a number of jurisdictions aren't having serious discussions about supply. That said, I also think this discussion is going to be useful for legalization discussions, simply because especially here in the United States, when jurisdictions are talking about legalizing, they're usually going to limit the market to those who are 21 and older. We'll realize that 20 to 25% of all of the marijuana consumed in the United States is consumed by those who are under 21. So what are we going to do with them post-legalization? Do we give them fines? Do we, subject them to brief interventions? I mean, I think the conversations we're going to have here about that today are going to be useful not only to possession, but also to some of these larger legalization issues. And so what I wanted to do, just to kind of kick off the discussion, is focus on three different questions. The first being, is decriminalizing cannabis possession actually controversial? Second question I want to touch is, how should we think about debt widening issues? And the third question is legalizing possession by itself a good idea? Now, as most of you know, the bulk of the research about decriminalization suggests that after it happens, most studies suggest that it does not increase cannabis use. If it does, it might be small. That's the bulk of the research. Now, last year, there was an outlier study, so to speak, published in the International Journal of Drug Policy. And it was looking at California's decriminalization, which started in January of 2011. This research group, they were using data from the Monitoring the Future study, so they were looking at self-reported past month use and reports of harm for 8th graders, 10th graders, and 12th graders. And they found that for the high school seniors, after decriminalization in California, it led to about a 25% increase in the number of high school students who were reporting past month use. this did get a lot of attention, and it was kind of, as I said, it was kind of an outlier from the rest of the literature, which suggests that decriminalization doesn't make much of a difference. Now, decriminalization happened in January of 2011. What else was happening in California in late 2010? Proposition 19. There was a huge debate going on about legalizing marijuana, and not just possession, but also supply. And there was a lot of discussion there. So if you're going to use that point, it's very hard. If you take these point estimates at their face value, it's very hard to determine whether or not they had anything to do with decriminalization, or it was more about kind of how perceptions were changing because of the debate that was happening. And in fact, Greg Majette, who's a colleague of mine who's in another session right now, and Peter Reuter have a commentary that they've been working on this, not only noting that it's really hard to attribute this all to decriminalization because of the discussion all about legalization, but also if you look at that study, it suggests that for the 8th and the 10th graders, their prevalence rates actually went down. And then they further begin to look at it with respect to kind of variation within California. And so this is one, this study got a fair amount of attention, but it's important to realize that this isn't, to me, it doesn't change my prior on this, that decriminalization for the most part doesn't increase consumption. And so that's why on one hand, this really isn't a very controversial issue. I mean, Kevin here, I mean, who's leading the anti-legalization movement, I mean, his organization for the long time has been calling for civil penalties. And we're going to hear more about that soon. And I would say most of the people at this conference probably would be in agreement that possession of small amounts should not be a criminal offense. I feel confident about that. That said, the controversy comes afterwards. Okay, so we pick up somebody, who we do arrest them. What do we do? Do we give them a brief intervention? Is there a fine? What happens if they don't pay that fine? I think that's where the real controversy is. And I'm glad, Norm, I'm glad you kind of had suggested some different alternatives to, alternative policies we should begin thinking about, because I don't think we really know what the best approach is here. You know, and some people, they react to this and say, well, we should just do what we do for alcohol. And, you know, and that varies by state. But I don't know if we're doing the best thing with alcohol, especially when we're dealing with minors there. So, yeah, so on one hand, this isn't controversial at all. But when you get down to kind of the nuts and bolts, I think it really is in terms of what should actually happen to people after the fact. The second issue I want to talk about is with respect to net widening. And this is the idea that after a policy change where you liberalize the policy, you may actually get more people into the criminal justice system. And the classic example here is in South Australia with a cannabis expiation notice, where they had depenalized possession of, I think at one point it was 10 plants, and then they decreased the threshold over time, and it was just going to be a fine. Well, it turns out they ended up having more people getting prosecuted and incarcerated for minor cannabis offenses because they weren't paying their fines. And so it leads to real issues in terms of when you're trying to project what's going to happen. And 2 years ago, I was doing some work. John Calkins mentioned we were doing this work for the state of Vermont, trying to help them think about legalization issues. Part of that was trying to help them also figure out, well, how much money are you actually spending enforcing prohibition in the state? Well, it turns out in July of 2013, they had actually decriminalized possession there. So after July 1st of 2013, if you got caught with less than an ounce, your first offense would be a $200 fine, your second offense would be a $300 fine, and then your third offense would be a $500 fine. And what we found is if you looked at the year before that policy change went into effect, there were about 1,600 kind of criminal offenses on the record for marijuana in Vermont. Vermont's a very small state. They have about 700,000 people. And sure enough, after they decriminalized so this is kind of looking at the year later, after July of 2013, you saw that the total number of criminal offenses went from 1,600 to 1,300. So it was a reduction in terms of 1,300 people who would have actually had a criminal offense, now just had a civil penalty. But what we also found is while beforehand you had 1,600 total offenses, the year afterwards you had 1,900 total offenses. Meaning that there were other people that were kind of getting picked up. They were still getting picked up for, they're being, you know, sentenced for a civil offense. Now, maybe it was just an increase in consumption. Maybe law enforcement was the same, but it was an increase in consumption that led us to go from 1,600 to 1,900. I'm doubtful about that. I don't think there was really a 20% increase, but, you know, it is hard to try to figure out what's happening with respect to kind of state-specific prevalence rates. So it might have actually been an example of an increase in net widening. Now, that said, I mean, just that kind of trend analysis isn't going to prove this. I mean, we want to get data, you know, going back and looking forward. But just for the sake of argument, let's actually say that it was all net widening. So because of this change in the law, you have 1,300 people who otherwise would have had a criminal offense now had a civil offense. But you weigh that against those who, you now have 300 people who are now part of the criminal justice system who may not have been part of the criminal justice system had it not been for that marijuana offense. Now, how do we weigh those? That's very difficult. It comes into projections in terms of what you think it means to come into contact with the criminal justice system. I don't have an answer to this, but I want to raise this, you know, as we have, you know, as more countries and more states have these discussions about decriminalization, we do have to take net widening seriously and begin thinking about what the consequences could be, but also begin thinking about whether or not we want to take actions to try to reduce it. And actually, and this leads me to my third point about just straight up legalizing possession. Because that's what some people argue. Because of this risk of net widening, we may just want to legalize possession for adults over a certain age. This would help deal with some of the, you know, the net widening issues. It could potentially reduce some of the racial disparities. But it's not necessarily going to be without trade-offs. I mean, I think Mark was right in terms of with all of these different options, you know, there are going to be pros and cons. And so if you think about, hypothetically, if you think about legalizing possession, you know, it might be easier for dealers to hide as users. One wonders potentially about the signal it sends. Does decriminalization send a different signal than legalizing possession and actually having that word legalization? I don't know. But, you know, this isn't necessarily an academic discussion. Vermont last week, so their Senate, the Vermont Senate passed a bill to legalize very much on the commercial market, like in Washington and Colorado. The House has been more resistant to legalization. And in fact, it was just last week, the House Ways and Means Committee passed a bill to which would essentially legalize possession. So if you get caught with less than an ounce, you would no longer be fined. But then would also legalize possession of up to two plants. I was just talking to Bryce about this. I'm not sure whether or not you might have to register the plants. But this isn't an academic discussion in terms of thinking about this legalizing possession. And so it raises this issue to me, I mean, to the extent that there are a number of places that are looking to reduce the, kind of the role of the criminal justice system when dealing with marijuana policy. I mean, one option is just to focus on the demand side. Yes, there are pros and cons when you deal with kind of supply issues. But it raises this issue in terms of with legalizing possession, you know, especially for places where, you know, where legalization and supply issues really aren't on the table. Would it make sense for them to begin considering legalizing possession? And I don't know. I mean, like I said, I think there are going to be trade-offs. But it seems to me that if you're a risk-averse jurisdiction, one thing you could do is just implement it with a sunset law. So you know what we're going to do? We're going to legalize possession for 3 years, for 4 years. And at the end of that time period, we could either pass legislation to kind of continue with this, or we could start with something else. And so this is kind of this is something I want to talk about. I haven't given this much kind of a, I haven't analyzed this or kind of come up with numbers on this. But I think it's something worth discussion, especially for these risk-averse jurisdictions that are really trying to reduce not only kind of the criminal justice burden in terms of criminal justice costs, but also for those jurisdictions that really are trying to reduce the number of people that are getting arrested and then all the collateral consequences that come along with that. So with that, I will close, and I look forward to having a conversation about this. So thank you.
Thanks very much, Bo. And same test as before. Main questions and discussion for after the speakers. But anything specific in what Bo said to us there for clarification from anyone?